Welcome to the CEN Show, a platform where we learn from the world community. I'm your host, Roski Mascani, and this evening on the panel is Brother Ahi. Professor Ra is supposed to join us as soon as he can. So this evening, we have a brother named Attorney Larry Fields, and I came across this brother. Maybe I say about 9 months ago, or maybe about a year ago, and he's the host of the podcast, The Level Set. And I'm telling you, these gentlemen on that show are professionals. They're educated, and they're black. And I have a great time listening to their commentary and educational lessons. It's extremely joyful to have these brothers come on and share the information that they share. And I would like to also share their YouTube channel. The thing about it is, when you have something that's good, and this is my opinion, but I think I have a good site for recognizing talent in different areas, and I've been doing podcasting for over 4 years now, and I also listen to podcasts. I listen to supposedly the conscious, community. And when you listen to the conscious community, and that's black people mainly, supposedly conscious, I see people doing very immature things. And I just joined the 60s now, so I've been around for a little while, and I think I have some type of sense to recognize excellent talent. So Professor Rod and Brother Mashinda just joined us, and that's our regular crew here for the CN show in Conscious Corner. You'll find all four of us here majority of the time, and that's a good thing that we show up and share information. But back to the guests, their information. I need to show their YouTube channel so people can start subscribing and listening to these brothers, because it's a phenomenal information, and we as people, and I'm talking about all people, need to hear these brothers. I'm about to do that right now before I get to him. And matter of fact, I'm going to go ahead and let him get started. Brother Larry, I appreciate you coming tonight. And man, we want to know a little bit more about you. And then we want to get into the topic for this evening, employment discrimination. Welcome, brother.
Well, thank you so much, and thank you all for having us, and thank you for actually bolstering our show. Our exchange with you has made our show a lot better, a lot sharper, and our exchange and this relationship, this Midwest West Coast relationship, has done a lot for us, and we are all very, very grateful of that, and Dr. Charles Alexander for making those connections. But as it relates to me, I guess we all have these moments where, when we look back just briefly over the arcs of our lives, and the older you get, the wiser you get if you were maturing. And I look back at some things that occurred in my past, and sort of in preparation for today, and sort of put the puzzle together as to, why I am in this space where I am today, firmly entrenched in a discipline that is a very, very difficult space to be in terms of in terms of, professionally, in terms of employment discrimination and civil rights work, and how I got there. But when I went back, I looked at my upbringing, and it's quite obvious that the individuals that reared me, and I was raised in St. Louis, Missouri, for the most part, and I lived there until I, went away to school. I look back on that upbringing. The elders of that church were, clearly Garveyites, and these are individuals that were that whose entire basis was for us to be self-sufficient. I mean, the church had, a car wash, a grocery store. My first job was in one of the confectionaries at 9 years of age that they had. They had several grocery stores. They had a tuxedo spot. They had, I don't know if you all remember H Salt Fish and Chips, the franchise, which was a seafood franchise that was the precursor to Long John Silver's. So, we're in the midst of all of that, and it was a unlike the, typical churches. It was a very, very strong male population there. Not perfect, had a lot of the misogyny that you see. I mean, extremely misogynistic. They're and conservative. Women couldn't wear pants and that sort of thing. So, but it wasn't perfect. But the thing about it is, and the thing that was ingrained and inculcated into me, and I can see my siblings, my sisters and my brother, was the need and the demand to be self-sufficient. And that translates into whatever you do, whatever job you subsequently take on, because I look at the jobs that I had, immediately thereafter. There was a as a high schooler, I worked in Wohl Laboratory, and I was responsible for lab animals and the test. I worked for two doctors that were attempting to cure diabetes, and so my responsibility was to, make sure that I took samples and provided insulin to, dogs and rats. And so, over the weekends during the school year, I was solely responsible for that. And during the summers, I did that full time. But the thing that was, I think that connects the dots is that in being ingrained to be self-sufficient and to work independently, by the community that essentially reared me, was something that I, that's just in you. And I mean, and it's still here to, to this day. I mean, and so those are the things that I, as I look back and you talk about me, that's what it, and it started at home because I had a father that was, a journeyman, tool and die man, which is at the top of the trade. He worked for McDonnell Douglas, and my mother was a nurse. Of course, my mother never worked out the house, but those are the things that that really were the foundation for me. Fast forward past undergrad and law school, and the work that I did was, after clerking for Algernon Marbley in the Sixth Circuit in Columbus, Ohio, began to work at a boutique law firm who represented the NAACP on some matters and represented the Democratic Party in some matters. And what we did there is we did gerrymandering litigation. So we would attack the composition of the gerrymandering in certain areas. And what I found there is that it is, that's when the depression began to set in on how easily it was to get individuals from our community to co-sign things that were in our direct best interest, that were, the exact converse of what we should have been doing. I can remember one of the first cases that we had that I worked on. We had a gentleman that was a member of the NAACP in Dayton, Ohio. The Republicans from the state of Ohio went and got him, hired him to rubber stamp this egregious gerrymandering proposal that they had. And so he worked out of his basement. They paid this guy $25,000 to essentially rubber stamp this, and this egregious gerrymandering plan. So and we deposed him, and it was one of the most depressing things you've ever wanted to see, how this man could sell out not just the whole state, but Ohio is central to the Congress. And although the gerrymandering didn't affect the Senate, but the U.S. Senate, but I mean, it's just amazing how you have these individuals that, as Mike Jones calls them, entrepreneurial politicians, that would sell you out for a drop of the hat, and they dropped a hat. So and so after leaving that firm, I started my own firm in D.C., in Washington, D.C., and that's when we began to do the employment discrimination work. But I started out doing juvenile work in D.C., and I think that that probably was the most challenging period of my life professionally. And I fast forwarded past owning a sports licensing company, which is how I got to law school, working for Pitney Bowes, working for a conservative bank, and so forth. I fast forwarded past all of those things. But the actual issue with respect to getting the working for these the juveniles in DC was just, it was the most depressing thing you ever want to do, because the actual you could really write the police reports every day without seeing them. I can tell you what's going to happen in DC tonight, right now. There are going to be several beautiful young men arrested with dreads, and right now they would probably have goose down shirts on with Jordans on or Timberlands on. They'll have roughly $150 cash on them. They'll catch them with, probably, 15 packets of heroin at this point. And the next time I see a father at an arraignment, it'll be the first time. The mothers typically suffer from some sort of addiction, and these young men are scrambling to take care of their younger siblings most of the time. And the women, the young ladies, will be underage individuals that were picked up for prostitution or fighting. So, so that, steered me in the direction of, okay, how do we combat this? The one thing I said that I wouldn't do in law school was employment discrimination. I took a class from a gentleman that was the head of the EEOC, but how do we spearhead this? But some things choose you. And I've never regretted being in it a day in my life. And here's the reason why. When you have an employment discrimination client, typically, you are affecting at least three generations. You have that individual's child, and that individual's parent, is what I find in the vast majority of my cases. Because those individuals, my clients are taking care of younger children and parents. And, the anecdotic information clearly states that individuals whose parents are not, who suffer from employment discrimination, their children, take on a higher tendency of student loans. They own homes at a much lower rate than other folks similarly situated do. They establish debt prematurely. And the individual that's sandwiched in the middle of them, typically, develop, what we call in Missouri garden variety distress, emotional distress, which is, a legal term, a legal cause of action that we attempt to use to the chagrin of the defense body. But it's, oftentimes undiagnosed emotional distress that has, a marker of loss of sleep, change in gait, ability to walk, headaches, inability to accept compassion, inability to provide compassion and affection. And so these issues that we deal with every day are issues that, not only affect your economic well-being, but your emotional well-being and your family and loved ones. And we're in an age right now where you have entire bodies that are cavalier with your employment. They don't, I mean, I can remember when individuals' names were being transferred for Social Security numbers. I'm showing my age now. And so now, when employers make these, they make these decisions, they're not looking at faces. I mean, the employees are fungible. And so they used to, we used to be able to say that America treats the black community like a colony, and the only thing, and our major export is labor. Well, that's not the case anymore. With the changes in the laws that have, occurred throughout the country, everyone is treated that way at some point, particularly as we begin to age. The workforce is really no admirer of an aging worker. They are not. They want the productivity that they can get. And in addition to the productivity, since you've been at the corporation or nonprofit or profit or for-profit corporation for X number of years, you've risen on the pay scale. And so if I can get rid of you and get two individuals that have half the experience that you have, I can pay them half of what I'm paying you, and they'll be much more productive, and they don't even know what to ask for at this age. So that's what's, that is, I mean, we're seeing that more and more and more. I probably represented more nurses in the in St. Louis and more firefighters in St. Louis than anyone. And I see this every day. One of the most sophisticated groups of professionals, in my opinion, are black female nurses. I've never met one that was not sharp enough to be a doctor. I've never represented one that wasn't sharp enough to be a doctor, but they just decided not to go further because of the, the debt associated with it. And they are typically in multiple businesses. But after the age of 40, like I said, these hospitals and corporations will do everything they can to replace them with someone right out of school that they don't have to pay as much. And what they do to our first responders is criminal. When you are a firefighter, the things that you do are contrary to your entire sympathetic system. We are built on, our sympathetic system is built on being safe. I mean, it's still archaic and and it craves on safety. The way your system thinks is, I got to stay ahead and away from this dinosaur. But when we have a first responder, we have an individual who's everything about their system is telling you to go the other way. That house is on fire. It's not safe for you to do that. You've got to go the other way. So what happens is your body pumps itself up with adrenaline, your heart rate, races, so forth, and your courage allows you to essentially disconnect the speedometer. And so you're redlining emotionally, and your body is, doing all of these things that, lead to hypertension, that lead to weight, weight gain, and so forth. And they do this for years. And upon years and years and years, and I don't know about in California, but the vast majority of Black firefighters in St. Louis were stellar athletes in high school and in college in some instances. And you see these guys, and their bodies have been through the ringer. It is, widely believed that the life expectancy of these firefighters, typically is, 10 years after retirement on a good day. What I have seen done to these firefighters by these municipalities and cities is criminal. So, I mean, those are the fights that we're engaged in. Of course, we have now, since this new administration has taken over, I've never had so many CEOs in my office within a month's time as I have here lately. I have no less than five individuals from the C-suites between Christmas and King's birthday that have been fired for no reason whatsoever. Now, in Missouri, you can fire individuals for no reason whatsoever, but it cannot be for an illegal reason. They cannot fire you for, as a result of your sex, race, creed, color, national origin, or age. But in each of the instances that we have, that I've spoken of, that was one of the main impetuses. And I'm sure you all are tired of hearing this trope, DEI, when, diversity, equity, and inclusion, when number one, the number of individuals that are impacted by those jobs is probably less than 1,000 in the United States, because the only ones that I am, that I would really consider DEI positions are the individuals that are in those offices making those hires. And the vast majority of those are white females anyway. And so this trope is being used as cover to get rid of individuals by boards and other governing bodies that I'm seeing way too often. And it is, it is problematic. And you couple that with the fact that you have a number of agencies that have been gutted with this administration, NLRB, the EEOC. All those agencies have now been, essentially beheaded by this current administration. So where does that leave us? Well, with respect to the EEOC, if there is no one processing things, we're nowhere. Because, when you file a complaint with respect to the EEOC, or in the case of Missouri, the Missouri Commission on Human Rights, California has a Commission on Human Rights, Illinois has a Commission on Human Rights. You cannot file a suit in court in Missouri, or in federal court, nor in state court, without what's known as a right to sue letter. The right to sue letter only is established only after there's been an investigation of some sort. If there's no one there to do the investigation, guess what? You don't have a right to sue letter. And guess what? If you don't have a right to sue letter, you can't sue. So we have an entire body of law that's being adversely affected by an executive action, not, and the action being eliminating the heads of the EEOC, eliminating the head of the National Labor Relations Board, so the NLRB doesn't even have a quorum right now. And we're in a space that we've never that I've never been in professionally. And this is a priest, all of these programs have, their genesis in the 1964 Civil Rights Act. And so it has been since 1964 that we've been in this particular space. And that's what we're dealing with on a daily basis and trying to keep people working. But that's the long or the short of it.
Okay, that's interesting. Lots of interesting occurrences that's happening now, and seem like throughout your career you done did a few things there, buddy. That's all right. So
Yeah, we.
let's go to Brother Ahi. Brother Ahi.
Yes, sir, brother.
Yeah, you have any questions or comments for Brother Larry?
No, I was just listening to him expound on his experiences and the fact that it's not. I was listening to you earlier saying that how you would discriminate against some of your own people, and I mean that's happened to me, and it happened a little later in my career, and that really hurt. That stung. After having to deal with white people being in a white folk world, you know, having to deal with their biases and stuff, and be really turned away from a position because of your people for no reason or little reason at all, it was just really stinging. And I can see where you really need it. And I'm sorry that you're so profitable. I mean, not profitable with it, but so busy. So busy. So many people are going through this, and it's not going to get any better. It's going to get worse with these positions starting to tighten up. But yeah, that's all I have to say and acknowledging that. That's really interesting. That's really interesting.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, it is really these claims in themselves are really, really personal. If you go out and get in a car accident, that's a personal injury, but that's random. But when someone attacks your work, what you've done, what you have labored over yourself as a professional or as, as a journeyman, whatever, and someone attacks you, your professionalism or whatever the actual motivation is, that is the most personal as an injury can get. There are very, very few injuries as personal as an employment discrimination case because you have spent your entire life getting to where you are right now. And I'm a firm believer in what August Wilson says. There's no such thing as history. Everything in your past is right here with you right now. So everything that you, every single fight you had to get here, every single challenge and hurdle you had to overcome is right here with you right now. And so when someone takes umbrage to that and wrongly discriminates against you, that is as personal as it gets.
Man, you said it. I'll tell you. All right. Thanks, Brother Ahi. Let's go to Brother Mashinda.
Good evening, brothers.
Good evening.
And my fraternal brother, Mr. Fields, how you doing tonight?
Oh man, everything is A-okay, brother. How you doing?
Hey, likewise. I'm
All
doing
right.
good. Yeah, but I like to I think you spelled out something. You put some things in perspective that because I try to like to think that I'm constantly trying to figure this thing out, as life goes on. And so you've provided some answers tonight, in terms of, from your perspective, your field of study, your work, what you've been doing, your experience. I appreciate you sharing that, because as I listen to you and other folks that offer something of value, I share it with others. I think that's very important that, and having this dialogue is very important. And, just listening to you, it seems like, with the current administration, seems like individuals' recourse in terms of, from a legal perspective is being diminished. And, so what's next? What's next in the in this process? Like you say, the EEOC and the the different organizations that fight for people and their rights, their job rights and things like that, and in your field of law. So what is next in terms of how to survive or how to attack that particular situation that's going on? Is there any hope? I mean, we all have hope, but you know what I mean? Just kind of, how do you feel about, is there going to be any change in terms of how we, in terms of what's going on? Are people going to have any recourse, or is that going to be lost for the next 4 years or more? Give me your opinion on that.
I think that's an incredible question, and one thing we do on our show, and you all do it here too, from what I've seen, we try and find solutions. We don't want to just spot the issues. What are the solutions? And the solution, are you in California?
I'm in Louisiana by way of California.
Okay, all right. Well, it's the same thing in Louisiana. We have got to drill down locally. We've got to, make our states adhere to what we need to happen. And we have more influence statewide, and we can have a bigger impact statewide than we can nationally at this point. And we can just hold on for 2 years until we can attempt to make an amends in Congress and in the Senate, well, in the House and in the Senate, and try and keep prevent a number of these radical judges that may not hold the law in the esteem that we traditionally would like to see them do that in. I'm not saying that it's been done that way, but what we would like to see done. So, I mean, if you look at California, I mean, if you look at the legislative acts of California this past year, you can't be mad about it. California did an incredible job of protecting independent contractors and protecting workers that are working in corporations that now or we want to attack the unions. California passed a, essentially codified the First Amendment rights of all of its workers to the point where you do not have to entertain an employer that wants to provide material and meetings with you that are anti-union in nature, nor can there be an incentive for those that attend those meetings. That's huge. Those are the sort of things that we have to have done. And in addition to that, we've got to continue to push. I mean, we can't let our federal representatives off the hook. We've got to push them, let them know that there will be another election at some point. And if you're on the wrong side of these issues, you're going to be on the wrong side of my vote. And we have to continue to call and to organize and to stress that. And at the same time, we need to do whatever it is necessary to create opportunities for ourselves, because there are going to be opportunities in this mayhem. Chaos can only last for so long, and then something has to happen. So, I mean, there needs to be not just a resistance, but there needs to be a plan. Okay, this corporation is eliminating, black vendors. This is how I can compete directly with them, and this is how we could win. I can tell, I personally can tell you, and I'm not talking about what I heard, but I'm talking about being undercapitalized. I'm talking about having a slighted distribution chain. I have beat the big boys in the categories that I have worked in when I focused on those categories. If I, I will not be able to have the broad band that they have, and I couldn't when I had my licensing company. But in the areas that I worked in, I beat them in the locations that I was in. That's not going to change. We can do that. And so we need to have an external plan and an internal plan, a local plan and a national plan. And we can, we can overcome all of these things. But this is not a time to talk about how bad things are. We need to understand that this is something that they've worked on since over the last 60 years. This is what this they are exactly where they want to be. This is, where they want to be. I mean, if you can go back and read just about anything about the law and the structure, this is where a certain sector of the government has always wanted to get back to. So understand that. And the issue is, how do I protect myself? How do I, how do I thrive? Not just survive. How do I thrive in this instance? And these are the ways to do it. There's no way you can operate in this country without our contributions. But the issue is, what is it going to cost us to provide those contributions in light of what we're doing? Because they're rolling back everything they possibly can. All of the workers' rights are on the table federally. There is a there has had been a great deal of headway in terms of paying overtime to individuals that were categorized as professionals. And so, it has, the argument that the National Labor Relations Board was saying, if you're not making more than $670 a week, you're not a professional. So these people need to get overtime. So regardless of what's going on, well, this administration is going to be hostile to that. So how is this, they will name you an assistant manager or, and work you 80 hours a week at that assistant manager, at that, exempt status. So what do we do statewide? Well, we have to organize, and we've got to make our state representatives protect us against that. That's what we have to do. So, I mean, it needs to be, nothing can be taken off the table. I mean, we've gotten too comfortable, number one, waking up in a world where we don't run any of our essential, needs. We don't control the water. We don't control the electricity. We don't control the gas. We don't control distribution of anything. And we're comfortable with that. With an individual that has told you that they are your, they have absolutely nothing good in store for you. So we have, I mean, this is a time to really take note of where we are and to understand. I mean, now you see that this is, you've been, waged, there's been a war waged upon you. So now we have to work in concert in all of these different areas, in my opinion, to put ourselves in a position to be self-sufficient to the extent that we can.
Great answer. Great
Thank
answer.
you.
Okay, Professor Roth.
Yeah, how you doing, Attorney Fields?
Professor, I'm hanging in there. I don't have any complaints. How are you this evening?
I'm just as black as I can be.
That's a beautiful thing.
Your subject matter is challenging. Because even with litigation, it takes so long. The person being starved to death, and then we're in the case, and they dead. It's a different. The courts are just as corrupt as the person that's discriminating against them. So that's one. Second, it's costly if to have an attorney. If you can't hire your private attorney, you got to rely on those that work for associations like NAACP, Civil Liberty, or somebody to pick up your case if it's that blatant. They're not going to take it unless it's blatant because, of the cost that goes along with when an attorney's involved, sometimes they have to pay people to write their motions and write their things if they don't have in-house writers, and it can be very taxing on attorneys to file discrimination. That's why many African American attorneys don't get into that, except for like, it's just a thing that you choose to do, or it's an opening for you to get experience. So you work with these organizations and issues that gives you the legal experience to go before the court. But that's not what I want to talk about. There's a time here, 100%. was no age discrimination and nothing. That was in the Holocaust of enslavement in this country. And to a certain degree, it has not changed up to today, as you have been saying. It's just different. You have to learn discrimination language, like you learn legal language. You know, you know, half time we don't understand legal terms if we're not an attorney, you know. And if you don't study discrimination and see how they have developed different languages in different eras and different policies, not just laws. Like you said, you were fighting discrimination laws and things of this nature, but they got policies and customs that, you know, good old buddy things, you know, your employer in these small towns and areas you're talking about, know the judges, know the attorney generals and all of that. And, you know, they look for quick settlements if it's real blatant, but if it's not blatant, they just, you know, you don't become a priority as far as getting a court date or getting leverage or putting your whole case together. They just stall you. They stall you. They waste your time. But anyway, the issue that I want to raise with you, and you can respond, is first of all, you know,
you're breaking up. You're breaking up, Professor.
You know what I'm saying?
And Professor Rock, can you okay. repeat that? We couldn't hear you.
Okay. I was saying that the areas, can you hear me now?
Yes, yes. Sir.
Can you hear me?
Yes, yeah. Sir.
Okay, so the area, you know, we had 100% employment because most of it was agricultural work and labor. And people left the South the way Latinos leave in their countries coming for work. We went to urban areas because they had service jobs, you know, cleaning the houses and, you know, just basic labor, you know, a fundamental labor. Didn't require a college education or anything, just backbreaking work. You know, I mean, that's what we was involved in. And now it got so technical that if you're not computer literate, you can't even fill out the application because everything's online. And that's the way they discriminate. Second, they criminalize Black people. You get a parking ticket in certain jobs you can't even apply for. Police, certain sheriff, fire department just require a high school diploma. But they got a test that they grade. And just like hotels and other employment places code your application, they could code your test that this is a Black person taking this test. And they can, you know, and they can say, well, your answer in your essay wasn't correct, or your answer in certain things. There are different ways in which discrimination come about that's very hard to detect unless you are a discrimination detective. And most attorneys are not that. They are legal, you know, people. So the challenge is that the unemployment based upon not just discrimination, but oppression, saturating the communities with drugs, immigration, getting lower workers. I mean, it's a whole new different game out there. Now, you came up in a strong family. Your mother was a nurse, your daddy was a professional, and you two-parent home. We don't have that today. You know, you got kids, you know, your grandmama may be 35 years old now. You know, and times have changed where the grandmama partying with the grandchildren. And so I'm just saying the times have changed. In my oppression. As long as I have a little drug, got some food, a place to sleep, I'm good. You understand? They take away your sense of ambition. And that, because he was saying, self-discrimination. You putting yourself down. You lose your self-esteem. You don't have no desire. Even with opportunities out there, from community college to skill centers, you ain't going. You understand? Because you're comfortable and you think that, you know, that's, this is okay. You know, as long as I can party, got me a girlfriend or whatever, a man friend or whatever, it's hard. So I don't know how many cases these attorneys fighting discrimination get a year. I don't know how many they win a year. But I do know that the apathy among black people toward work and to, you know, because, you know, you got to have some skills nowadays to get a decent salary. You know, even though labor in certain industries is real high, you know, you go take your car into a dealership and the labor is $100 an hour. You can change your average, charge you $200. You know, wow, I would take out an hour. Didn't go with him, then you had to pay for the battery. So, you know, it's a different game out there when it comes to white people's labor. And then you got nepotism, you got cronyism, you got prepper, like you were saying, these athletes getting jobs at the fire department, that's preparation to a certain degree, because they were athletes and somebody knew somebody and got them in. Because, I mean, I haven't seen it, brother. I've been fighting this stuff in poverty program. And the majority employment of black people is the public sector. The public sector. Private do what they want to do. But the public sector, government job, teaching job, public service job, like you were saying, police and fire department, those are jobs reserved for white folk. And if you get in as a black person, it's generally in a black community, you know what I mean? And you spend years there, you know? I mean, it's just a challenge. But my question to you is, and it's not just this administration. We've been suffering employment discrimination against every administration since these administrations in this country, from Kennedy to Obama, to things of that nature. I mean, you know, they say, well, black employment is down, I mean, down to 9%, 7%. That's them counting. I know figures don't lie, but liars do figure. And just to make you feel that you're doing something, and you can go out in the street and see the homeless people that ain't working and know that their employment is like taking the census. You can't count the homeless. You don't know where you, most people won't even let you in their house. So you don't know. Only way you tell that there's a bunch of people is traffic time and how much toilet paper you sell in the store. Then you know that there's more people than they're saying live in your area. But anyway, how do you respond to the fact that it's beyond racism? You know, to a certain degree, racism is the basis. But I'm just telling you, they ain't even hiding it. They're just straight out saying it's legal to get rid of DEI. It's legal in a policy to get rid of educational opportunity programs for college, cutting off financial aids and things. Like I said, we need a strategy. I agree with you. And we need money and resources. But how do you foresee the future? I'm just trying to do the playing field, as you say.
Ron, did you hear him?
I think his question is, how do I see the future in light of everything that is going on right now? And I think that is the question. That is the question.
They got robots. They got robots. They got AI.
That's one on my list of things that I think we need to talk about. A couple of things. Technology. Amazon just laid off, you know, virtually an entire plant and replaced them with robots. That they pay, I think the robots are, you know, cost, you know, roughly $13,000 a piece. They don't take any breaks. They work 24 hours a day. That's going to be an issue for us. But what we what some of these young work, not even young, but this workforce is now rallying around the gig economy. You know, taking back their agency, working in the gig economy with Uber, Lyft, and so forth. You know, I don't know how that's going to work out. I don't know if you can put a kid through school with that. I don't know. But these are things that are that are now being used in face of this harsh system. So, and you're 100% right. The middle class was largely based on the public sector. You know, these federal jobs that this administration, you know, wants to move out of Washington, D.C. into places like Alabama, Tennessee, you know, in Georgia, in certain areas. Those were the jobs that made specifically the black middle class in D.C. and Virginia and, you know, other areas. There's a large federal contingency of black employees in just about every state where black people are. So that is going to pose a serious challenge to the viability of several communities. I don't know how that's going to turn out. I don't know that you can replace those jobs. Now, there has been litigation this week surrounding this administration's ability to offer a severance to every, you know, to every federal employee. And it's not even a severance, because essentially what they said is, you know, you take off from now until August, we will pay you. Then, you know, you'll be, you know, we'll separate you at that time. Well, that's illegal. And the unions have sued. And despite the fact that the union endorsed this present president of the United States, they are now suing this guy. In addition to that, union membership has cascaded through the roof. They, you know, they are now asserting that, you know, almost 10,000 people are joining the union every day now. So, I mean, that is somewhat encouraging, because when individuals, and I'm a union baby, let me say that I'm partial to the union. My father was in the union, and I attended union meetings at a very, very young age consistently. And so I understand the strength of these unions. And so hopefully they can stem the tide here. But this is going to be a challenge. There is no one answer to this. I don't have the one answer. And you hit it right on the head. It takes generally 4 to 5 years from the time an individual walks in an employment discrimination attorney's office until that case gets before a jury. It's going to be about 5 years. So we, you know, we have challenges, and all we can do is fight and strategize and, you know, change these strategies on the fly when we need to be. We're going to have to be adroit afoot here, because this administration has a plan, and they are, you know, from inauguration day till June, they have a daily checklist of what they want to accomplish. And none of those things are in the benefit of any American worker.
They are out to get us, like they've always been doing. So it's just a little bit more overt at the moment. All right. We have another level set brother here, and he's also been on the CEN show and have visited the Conscious Corner a few times. It's our other brother, Dr. Charles Alexander. Welcome, Dr. Charles. Thanks for joining us.
Good evening, Brother Ross. Good evening, Brother Rod. And good evening.
Hey, how you doing, brother?
I'm great.
Good to hear your voice.
Good evening, all the rest of the brothers. Good to hear you too, brother. Yeah. Attorney Fields, you alluded to this a little bit, but can you say, can you say a little more about, you know, tort reform and why tort reform, even, why that was an issue, and how it and how what we're seeing now is really just kind of a ongoing assault that kind of started with tort reform.
Well, it's good to hear your voice in the middle of the week, Dr. Alexander.
Yes, sir.
But yes, once again, you recognize the pattern. What there are a couple of things that expedited that here in Missouri. In Missouri, we had we implemented term limits. When you implemented term limits, we got rid of all of the seasoned representatives in both the Senate and the House. So the only constant that was there was the lobbyists. And what is the, if so, you have brand new representatives and senators that don't even know how to write a piece of legislation. This is the reality of it. But who does know how to write it? The lobbyists. And what else does the lobbyists have? Money. So what happened here is that the lobbyists went out and they created a legislature that they wanted. And those individuals in the legislature were reliant upon them for both their practical knowledge and for their financing. So when the tort reform took place here in the state of Missouri, guess who wrote the laws? The tort reform, the defense lawyers. That's who wrote it. Keep in mind, because the defense bar is an institution. Plaintiff's bar is a, you have a number of plaintiff's attorneys that may have, three or four attorneys in one office. You may have one or two super offices, but by and large, these are in, small operations. And you have MATA, you have the organizations, but the defense attorneys represented institutional monies. They're, and they had unlimited resources. So they could buy up entire legislatures. And their clients were dogged. And here, what happened, excuse me, that was the flashpoint for the reform and employment discrimination law was a case against Enterprise Leasing, where a whistleblower against Enterprise Leasing won a major a verdict against Enterprise Leasing. Enterprise Leasing made it their mission to buy up the legislature and to bring as many businesses as they could with them. So in tw and they were successful. So in 2017, here in Missouri, the entire law was changed to mimic the federal laws. The federal laws has a standard that was cultivated based on the case of Percy Green versus McDonnell Douglas. With that rubric in that specific case, in that specific case, a plaintiff had to assert a discriminatory issue. Then the defendant had to come back and say that this was a legitimate issue. Then the plaintiff had to rule that that issue that or that defense that's being put up by the defense is pretextual. So it's a three-part step. In Missouri, that wasn't the case. In Missouri, the discrimination only had to be a contributing factor. That's it, contributing factor. It is much harder after after a company says that this was, that this is the legitimate reason why we did what we did. They were just coming back from FMLA. And they've had a stellar career, but we got rid of them not because they were using FMLA or not because they had cancer, but because somebody made a complaint against them on the employee line, an anonymous complaint. That wouldn't fly in the state. But after Enterprise Leasing went and brought the legislature up, they changed the Missouri state law to mimic the federal law in the same vein as tort reform. They went through and they had employment discrimination reform, and we've been rebounding ever since. What else did they do? They put a cap on what you can receive in employment discrimination. In Missouri, the statute is Section 213.055. There was no cap, but there was a general operation that your damages would not be more than 10 times what your compensatory damages are. Compensatory damages, we would put in lost wages, lost vacation, so forth. So if that's $100,000, typically courts would overturn any judgment over 10 times that, $1 million. And you'd have a verdict directed. Well, now the caps across the board is $500,000. And that's if you have over, 100 employees in your firm, in whatever business concern. If it's under 50, if the employer only has less than 50 individuals, it's less than that. I think it's 100,000 is the max you can get. So they gutted it. And businesses essentially wrote the law. And that's where we are. You have the inmates running the insane asylum. Does that
Wow.
answer your question, Dr. Alexander?
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Wow.
Thank you.
As you talk about these things related to what you do, is it all comes down to what are we gonna do, to combat it? And like you said, we got to do some things locally. I mean, we got probably we have to fight on all fronts, and it's got to be an organized effort. So I think we have some work to do as a unit. Start not only educating, but you may have to advise us on some things that we need to do. But we'll talk about it.
Absolutely. We will
It's
not take anything off the table. I firmly believe that we're going to win this fight.
and see, I want to show you guys something here. Bear with me. Bear with me. Here I come. Walking down the street. Okay. Look at here. We have our website here, which everybody is very much open to. But if you go to more right here, got community actions. At some point, and I think sooner than later, we got to do some things as a community. You guys are familiar with this, the hearings, South Africa versus Israel. That brother was bringing it. And this is just an idea right here, the black table. But we need to really get active as a unit to spearhead some actions throughout the community. We could do a joint St. Louis, Compton. My parents are from St. Louis. Oh, some type of joint activity to bring awareness and do some things that's gonna combat this. I mean,
One of my best friends is from Compton, Dr. Tyrone Howard.
Tyrone Howard.
Yeah, his father worked in state government there. He's a professor at UCLA now.
Tyrone Howard. Okay, what about his father? What's his father's?
I can't remember his father's name at this point, but
Tyrone Howard. Do you know his age around
yeah,
his age?
he's early 50s.
Okay, he's a little younger.
Yeah, he's a
Okay.
little young. But yeah, but we'll make that connection because he
Oh,
needs to be.
please,
Yeah,
please
because
do that.
he runs the graduates the graduate education department over there in some vein at UCLA. And he never has a tire, he never has a restful moment. He's constantly working with, working with black males is one of his, passions. So it's what he's doing.
Okay. Well, we definitely want to meet that brother. And but yeah, man, it's a good thing that we have people that are competent in certain areas to start giving some advising, because we definitely need to do something right now, really. So we need to talk, brothers. We do. So,
There's
Rob.
a lot of groups out there doing things. Even Dr. Fields is doing things. It's that they don't give us the recognition. And even when we win a big case, it don't hit the news. So it make you feel like you ain't doing nothing because they don't want to give you hope or give you a sense of inspiration that they're vulnerable. So they don't talk about their losses. That's why they always say Sitting Bull, Custer's last stand rather than Sitting Bull's victory. And that's the way these Europeans write their history. They always, the same way they write their movies, they always win at the end and they glorify violence. They give Academy Award to violence and things of this nature. But the point is that unemployment it will always be an issue until we get corporations and businesses to hire our own people. Mexicans hire Mexicans. Jews hire Jews. White people hire white people. That's the way it goes. And until you can get major corporations, and I ain't just talking about franchises and things of this nature. I mean, we can build major corporations if we have a cultural revolution, whereas we start eating specific foods that we grow and that we develop, wearing clothes that reflect our culture, our heritage, and that would build up the clothing industry. Right now, we spend more money going in there buying white folks' clothes and dressing up like them. You understand? I mean, it's a deep trip, man. It's about culture. It's about theologizing and ritualizing your existence. And that's what church is about. That's why he was talking about how strong that church was. How many churches have the many businesses that he talked about? Most of them are small, and most of them are just providing jobs for ministers. And most of them have three people in the choir. You understand? So, I mean, there's a church on every corner. You understand? Because it's a job. But at the same time, when you got a good big church like he had, where they had what, franchises and businesses and they had strong men that wanted to build the church financially. It's a
Pastor
different
Rob.
game when you got membership. That's what builds a church. It's the people that join the church. Don't just come to the church, but become a member of the church and pay their tithes and will them property and really think that they got to give it all up to get in heaven and that be a joyful giver, as they say. And I mean, it's a whole new different game out there, man.
Professor Rod, you
Yeah.
said something very important, and the Level Set show talks about it. Basically, what you were saying earlier is having a God agency. Dr. Charles, you want to talk about that real quick before we go?
You said agency?
Yep. Professor Rob basically just said that, but can you break it down too a little bit more?
I mean, for many things, we have an external locus of control, meaning that whatever's going on, typically when we're doing good, actually, when we're doing good, instead of us being able to find a way to acknowledge how we did what we did and why we did it, you know, we will say, you know, but God and only God. And there's nothing wrong with giving grace and thanks to God, but you did what you did. Now, you may have done it with the assistance, you know, and the blessings of the Lord, but you ultimately did what you did. And so it becomes problematic, because then when we find ourselves in these tough moments, you know, we either don't have the ability or we don't have the confidence to actually strategize, because we've been working from this external locus of control. And so, and what that does is, to Rashki's point, is that, and to the point that you made earlier, Barbara, it takes away our agency. And that is you know, a point that we have struggled with pretty consistently.
And it gets worse than that sometimes too. And I'm the one on the level set that's probably the churchiest. By far.
That would be true.
I'm the churchiest. But along those lines, there is doctrine being taught that we will remain fragmented and a mess until Jesus comes back with the millennial kingdom. Then everything will flip. And that's what's being, I mean, that is the doctrine. So what that means, and when you have that mindset, because, you know, it's in, that is in Deuteronomy. I think it's Deuteronomy 28. But when you have that mindset, it absolves you of not voting. It doesn't matter. It's not. We're not going to be straight till Jesus comes back. It absolves you of not having a plan. We're going to be a mess until Jesus comes back. And we have got to get rid of that. But if that made sense, King's work was in vain. If that made sense, Moses' work was in vain. You know, I mean, it just doesn't make sense. And what people fail to understand is, even when God told them he was going to give them land, he told them, you're going to have to fight to get the land, though. That's the land I want you to have. But you got to, you know, you're going to have to fight people to get it off your land. And we expect for God to be a genie, for us to be able to sit in a corner and us to, you know, rub his vase and him to go and do. And that's just not how he operates.
Well, and not only that, man. I mean, God is not a real estate agent, you know. No, never was and never will be. But people credit him with being one. And the other thing is that, you know, it's hard to tell people who are devout Christians, Muslim, Jewish, Buddhist, Hindu, that what they're practicing is wrong. I mean, they had the right to believe myths and believe things that could make them better people. Churches in our history as Black people did more than just spiritual work, as you were saying, Dr. Field. They were our welfare. Was our house system when people came in. There was a place you dress up, and you got together on Sunday and you saw each other because you worked 24 hours, 7 days a week, feeding your families in those little small towns. And then the church get prosperous, the community get prosperous. That's how Black Wall Street came into it. It was a strong church community. And we have to give the churches credit. They go beyond the myths of things and do work, versus churches that just say, hey, come to you on Sunday and let me give you a choir and let me make you feel good, hooping and hollering, hey, yeah, and all that, and put on a show like you at a concert and give you and take your money, but don't reinvest it in the community. Don't reinvest it in the church. And that's why they always have to change ministers. But the point is our unemployment employment discrimination is because we're still discriminated against, not just in employment, in every aspect of the social life.
Well, the
You know,
banking, the magnet, when you
look, look
talked
what
about
happened to Coleman.
the,
He just telling me, they whiteballed him. And he ain't the first that was whiteballed. You understand? I mean, we're discriminated in every in schools and education. I mean, they're all interconnected and interrelated. That's why it's exploitation. Because if any black people are discriminated, we all are discriminated because we all black. If they classify us as black, the hell would you classify yourself? You can tell you I'm colored, I'm multiracial and all of that. That ain't gonna get you nowhere. You understand? This system that determines what you are by how they treat you, not how you say you are. And no matter how much, like Doc Rivers told him on TV, we love this country, but they don't love us back. Boy, ain't that something? No. You know, they don't love us back. You know? No. Our issue is loving each other. I ain't saying don't respect all other human beings, but just teaching your kids from birth. But anyway, y'all, I mean, I can go on forever.
All right, brother Larry, can you close us out with some words?
I will. I'll do. Well, first of all, thank you all for having me.
Oh, and, man, our pleasure.
And the thing that we have to do, in my opinion, is take agency over ourselves and understand, number one, that America produces the outcomes that it wants. So the fact that we're in this position is not because of something that we have inherently done. It's structurally what it is. The laws have been set up to keep us a second-class citizen. The laws have been set up to protect the rich and the strong. And we win when we challenge that, when we challenge the status quo. We have to understand that. And that the wins may not be glare, you know, the broadcast all over the world. But we have to fight. And what I'm learning more and more, we've got to show up at every specific fight in the chain. And if you don't win, keep going. It's not over until you say it's over. And that's what we have to do. We've survived everything except integration so far. Let's get this thing figured out. We'll be fine. I know we can win. I know we can win.
We're winning.
Yeah, I know we. Well, I mean, and it's like Dr. Alexander said, I want to say last week, that we are certainly reliving Reconstruction, and that's based on the fact of the gains that we've made. And we have to keep that in mind. And we've got the other thing, I think the most important thing to keep in mind is that history and the present does not always encompass continued gain. Understand there are going to be some setbacks along the way. And this is one of those where we've got to continue to push forward. And we'll win. We always have.
Yes. Yes. Man, I appreciate it, man. This was great. Next week, you guys will be back.
God willing.
We got Mike Jones as the guest next week. And is Christmas gonna come, Kwame?
Kwame says that he's going to make an appearance. So we hope we can hold that too.
Let's see if he make the appearance a little different than when he make the appearance with y'all, but it's all good.
We will try.
Oh man, that's gonna be good next week. The level set crew, hopefully the whole crew will be here, and they're gonna interview Brother Mike Jones, political columnist. Mike Jones is our guest. Professor Rob, what we got going for next week, Tuesday?
We continue Black History Month, the struggle at Cal State Long Beach, and you know, just recognizing Black History Month, and you know, we just have different panels and different discussions by individuals that come in.
So we still, about so it's still experience. The same title,
same title, yes. Yeah,
Okay,
we're
good.
going from the 70 to 75 and trying to move all the way up to 2004.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well,
All right.
excellent.
All right.
Appreciate everybody's attendance. We're going to take our pause. Each one teach one.
Barry Sell.
Like right here. Each one teach one. Y'all see that? Yeah. In Conscious Corner. Everybody continue to have a great day.
You too. Thanks a million.
Thank you.
Good evening.